Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, Mapping an Obsession with Gavin Francis and his new book, Island Dreams.
Gavin Francis is an award-winning writer and GP. He is the author of four books of non-fiction, including Adventures in Human Being, which was a Scottish Times bestseller and won the Saltire Scottish Non-Fiction Book of the Year Award, and Empire Antarctica, which won Scottish Book of the Year in the SMIT Awards and was shortlisted for both the Ondaatje and Costa Prizes. He has written for The Guardian, The Times, The New York Review of Books and The London Review of Books, and his work is published in 18 languages. And Gavin's latest book, which we're going to talk about today, is Island Dreams, Mapping an Obsession. Gavin, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Well, thank you for having me on yet again, Neil.
So this book, Island Dreams, as it says in the subtitle, is about an obsession of yours with islands, and more specifically this idea of an island as an escape from our daily lives, our daily responsibilities. Tell me something more about that idea.
Well, the book grew out of a realization that my life had taken a trajectory which moved me between periods of time in the city of intense connection, sort of immersing myself in possibilities and the potential of the city, and then episodes of my life of quite extreme isolation, sometimes really very extreme isolation, often on small remote islands. And I realized that my life had this pattern of moving between one to the other. And I began to think about why that was, what I was getting from the possibility of isolation, the remoteness of that, and what I was getting by contrast from my periods of time in the city. And so as I began to kind of chart that and begin to make sense of that pattern my life has taken, I became really increasingly fascinated by the place in the cultural imagination that islands hold. The kinds of questions I began asking myself are, you know, why is it that Robinson Crusoe is still in print after 300 years? Why is it that Desert Island Discs is the longest running radio show on Radio 4? Why is it that we still have so many of great novels are set with their pivotal fields of action on an island? Because they kind of represent something for us. They represent a kind of possibility of possibly a purity and certainly an absence of distraction. For a lot of people, it's about peace, silence. And I wanted to explore all these different kinds of tropes through the culture, as well as how they've represented themselves in my own life again and again over the last 30 years.
And of course, in our sort of modern hyper-connected world, it becomes even more difficult to seek out periods of isolation, doesn't it?
Yeah, in some ways it becomes more difficult. But in other ways, I wonder, we're also used to being habitually connected constantly through our phones, that sometimes to feel a bit of isolation, all you need to do nowadays is switch your phone off. And it can give you a little hint of the thrill that maybe a century ago people had to go a lot further to try and get. So, yeah, I think there's something there to tease out between isolation from others and over connection to others. You know, sometimes what I see in the clinic is that our huge amount of connection that we've got through social media and through the possibilities offered by our phones can sometimes be bad for our mental health as well. We need a little bit of isolation in order to keep good mental health, I think. And that's another theme that I wanted to really thrash out through the pages of the book.
In terms of the ideas of isolation, you talk about the work of the psychiatrist Donald Winnicott, who was someone whose work I'd not come across before. So tell us who he was and what his thoughts on the importance of isolation were.
Winnicott is a wonderful writer, certainly. He was a psychoanalyst, a child psychiatrist. Through the 50s, he had a regular spot on the radio, and the short radio essays he did for that are published in a collection I can recommend to everybody called The Child, the Family, and the Outside World. And although they're 60, 70 years out of date, they still feel really very, very relevant. And one of the themes that Winnicott's particularly interested in was how much we need a modicum of isolation or a measure of isolation in order to maintain good mental health. And he proposed a distinction between isolation, which is good for us, and insulation, which is bad for us. He thought that psychopathology sometimes happened and people became mentally very unwell when they became too insulated and too cut off from the world. But similarly, if people didn't have the opportunity to explore a little bit of isolation, that too would be bad for their mental health.
You mentioned also that the book talks about the appearance of islands in literature, and I wanted to talk about a couple of examples. I mean, you mentioned obviously Robinson Crusoe, but perhaps let's talk about the real life Robinson Crusoe, Alexander Selkirk. Tell us again who he was.
Selkirk was he was a tanner's son who grew up in Fife, not far from where I grew up in Scotland, and there's not much known about his early life. Other than when he was 17 years old, he was called to the Kirk Session, which would have been, I suppose, the local magistrate equivalent, to answer charges of being unruly or brawling. And the Kirk Session recorded that he didn't show up having gone to sea. And so he went to sea through the later 17th century, and he became a kind of like a navigator on ships that were ultimately pirate ships, privateering expeditions. And in the early 18th century, he tried to force a mutiny of one of these privateering ships somewhere in the South Pacific because he believed his ship was unseaworthy, and the mutiny failed and the captain marooned him on Juan Fernandez Island just off the coast of Chile, well, a few hundred miles off the coast of Chile. And he survived there for 4.5 years, famously came back to London a wealthy man because another pirate ship eventually rescued him, and he got rich on the booty they managed to reap on their homeward journey. And Daniel Defoe heard about this man. He was interviewed. He was a kind of celebrity when he got back to London, and lots of journalists interviewed him. It's thought very much that the Robinson Crusoe story is based on Selkirk and his adventures.
And you mentioned the actual island, Juan Fernandez Island off the coast of Chile, and it's a place where other people were subsequently, you know, shipwrecked. It was a notorious island.
Yeah, I think it was quite a... I mean, there was plenty for him to eat because previous Spanish expeditions had let loose wild goats there deliberately so that if any expedition was passing that island, they would always know they'd be able to stop there and get fresh meat. So there were lots of seals, lots of crayfish to eat. There was wild goats. He, about 2 years into his isolation, a ship approached the coast and Selkirk ran down thinking he was going to be rescued, but it was a Spanish ship. And of course, as someone from the island of Britain, he would have been enslaved or killed if he'd been caught by them. So he ran and he was chased into the woods by the Spaniards, but they didn't catch him. It was another 2 years later before a British ship came and he was rescued. Yeah, and subsequently also there's further stories. There's a lovely book by George Shelvock, who was another pirate 10, 15 years later, who also put in to Juan Fernandez and offloaded some mutineers and refitted his ship there.
So Treasure Island, obviously, literally a novel by Robert Louis Stevenson about an island. And rather than talk about Treasure Island, I want to talk about Stevenson's own obsession with islands and his relationship with Samoa that you talk about in the book.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he, Stevenson had this kind of love-hate relationship with his hometown of Edinburgh. and where I live now. It was bad for his health. He was desperate to get away. He was a very kind of wealthy, famous celebrity by the time he was into his 40s, late 30s, 40s. And he moved, to Samoa, to the island of Upolu with his wife and stepson. And it's beautiful reading his letters from that time when he moved to Samoa. He died there of a brain hemorrhage. And the letters he wrote to his friends, as he had a literary executor, a chap called Sidney Colvin, talk about this great peace that he found there. You know, away from the demanding literary scene of Sydney, which he could have been on the way to, of California, New York, away from London and Edinburgh, he found a great peace just planting his garden, digging his garden on the shores of the Pacific. And I think when I read that, when I read the letters that Stevenson sent back, I was reminded very much of the Yeats poem, you know, the very famous Yeats poem about a lake island, a lake isle of Innisfree. And it says exactly the same thing. You know, I'll find my peace there, planting my rows of beans, essentially, on the lake island. And so it's another example, I think, of that kind of cultural fascination that we have with the idea of finally getting some peace, getting some absence of distraction.
I want to talk about some of your own travels to islands over the years. And I guess we should start relatively close to home and look at some of the islands that you talk about in Scotland. Obviously, you know, some of the, you know, the Hebrides, Harrison Lewis, but particularly I wanted to talk about some of the tiny islands that you talk about, Inchkeith and the Isle of May, which is an island that has quite a lot of importance to you over the years.
Yeah. Well, when I was a little boy, I used to have my family holidays were caravan holidays in the east of Fife. And quite often, as I would fall asleep in the caravan awning, I would look out and see this lighthouse blinking on the Isle of May. It's about 5 miles offshore, quite a small island. It's just under a mile long. And it's a bird reserve. There's nobody lives there year round, but there's nature wardens live there in the summertime. And I was fascinated by this place. I was given a book of artwork, paintings of the bird life and wildlife of the island. And I dreamed one day of going there. And then it was only much later in my life when I was at a very hectic stage. I was training as a junior surgeon. I had a very busy, stressful job in my late 20s. This island came back to me at a moment of my life when I really needed some silence and some rest. And I applied, when my surgical rotation was finished, applied to become a volunteer warden there. And so went straight from the high dependency units of the busy city hospital to essentially clearing paths and digging out wells and ringing birds in this place that was utterly, utterly different. And it wasn't solitary, because there was a wonderful community of ornithologists and naturalists that lived there during the summer. And it kind of exemplified that transition from the city to the island, exemplified the tension, the kind of opposing allures that I'm trying to map out with this book, about how both of them offer a kind of richness and have value, but the value comes almost in the contrast and in the transitions between the two.
I want to talk about another journey that you took, and this one was in East Africa, a particularly fractious time, but you end up on an island called Lamu.
This was following a period of time working in a small East African hospital. It was a very kind of stressful time politically in the country. There'd been a lot of riots, and travelling at that time had been quite difficult. There was very few tourists, and that had made a lot of the people who depend on tourism a lot more difficult to deal with, a lot more desperate in many ways. And I remember travelling up the coast from Mombasa up past Kilifi and Malindi, and eventually reaching this place, Lamu Island. And when I got off the boat to Lamu and jumped in, it was kind of with my rucksack balanced on my head, thigh deep in this tropical water. It was like, again, as if this complete transformation had taken place. And the atmosphere on that island was beautiful, very, very welcoming, very gentle. There was none of the stress and the difficulties of travelling on the continental mainland that I'd just left. And I was reminded when I made that of Auden's got something lovely to say about islands too. W.H. Auden wrote a poem. It was actually about Iceland, but I think it stands for a lot of islands, when he said that this is an island and therefore unreal. And there's a certain unreality to certain kinds of islands when we go there as outsiders. Of course, there's different when you're living on an island, when you're part of the community on that island, and that's maybe something else we'll have time to touch on. But one of the things I was interested in approaching with this book is not particularly the tensions of living in a small community on an island, which I have done, but of what it's like to go there from a much busier urban metropolitan kind of environment.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Gavin Francis, and we're talking about his latest book, Island Dreams, Mapping an Obsession. And Gavin, I want to go on to communities on islands now, because you spend some time at a monastery on Mount Athos in Greece. That's right. At a monastery. Tell us about that experience.
Well, I'd read a little bit about Athos. I mean, anybody who loves travel writing will have read Patrick Leigh Fermor's books. Patrick Leigh Fermor loved Athos and visited there at the end of his great journey that went into become A Time of Gifts. Bruce Chatwin, too, was a great fan of Mount Athos. And I'd read Robert Byron's book about Athos. And I knew that it was quite a difficult place to get to, that you had to be accepted by the monks and you had to get a kind of certificate or permit to be able to go there. And you had to sail there from a small port near Thessaloniki. And so a very kind of...
You have to be a man.
Yeah, you have to have a Y chromosome for some reason. I'm not sure how closely they check, to be honest. I think I remember I did have to show my birth certificate, but, you know, birth certificates can be erroneous. Anyway, I sailed there at another testing time in my life and was welcomed into this world that hadn't changed at all, really, for a millennium in so many ways. Some things the monks had adopted of modern technology, you know, they had solar panels and things like that, but other things were completely unchanged over 1,000 years. And the monks there have taken a vow of hospitality. So once you have one of these permits, then they take you in and they give you 2 meals a day in the bed for the night. And it's possible to just walk slowly around this peninsula, around this holy mountain of Athos, staying in the monasteries, whatever you like, wherever you turn up to.
The idea of the religious attraction of islands, of isolation, is threaded through the book as well. And you talk about Iona, for instance, at one point, but also the travels of the various Irish monks, including St. Brendan, to various different far-flung islands.
Adam Nicholson has a lovely thing to say in his book about the Shant Islands serum, where he says that the association of islands with holiness predates anything Christian. This is a very old association. And in the book, I try to make this connection almost between these places that we almost set aside for reverence, like Iona, like Inchcombe near Edinburgh, where I live, like Athos. There's similar examples throughout Asia. But at the same time, we use these spaces also for prisons, because they offer that same kind of, there's no possibility of going in and out. That almost increases their holiness, but it also increases their utility as places to put prisoners and offenders. So I wanted to try to tease out this association that they have, not only with peace, but also with imprisonment, not only with reverence, but also with transformation and the possibility of transformation that they offer. So St. Columba and Iona as example, St. Brendan and the voyage of St. Brendan visits all these different islands in the North Atlantic. And right here in my own front yard, you know, I've got Inchcombe, which has got a very ancient abbey. And just down the coast, there's the Bass Rock, which was used as a prison.
And another prison island that you talk about, former prison island, is the Andaman Islands, which is somewhere that is still, you know, relatively difficult to visit.
Yeah. No, I visited the Andamans from Chennai. I flew there to this archipelago, which from the outside just looks like a paradise. It just looks like all our picture postcard stereotypes of what paradise, palm tree, yellow, bright yellow sand, turquoise water type of place. But yeah, they were a really brutal prison operated by the British Raj for Indian dissidents. And when I walked around that prison complex where they were still keeping the gallows freshly painted, and I read the stories of what had gone on there, that kind of disjuncture almost between the peace that's possible in islands, but the horror that's possible on them too was really brought home to me.
We talked before, obviously, about Empire Antarctica, your book, a few years ago. And also in this book, you talk about often the travel to your time spent in the Antarctic and various places, islands in the South Atlantic, but also in sort of, you know, the far south, Tierra del Fuego, South America. And I just wanted you to tell us a little bit more about what those sort of places were like to visit.
Yeah, well, when I sailed as the ship's doctor one October from Immingham, Humberside, on a British Antarctic supply ship, and we sailed down, of course, you know, we passed Madeira, past the Canary Islands, past Fernando de Noronha, the Azores, all the way down to the Falkland Islands, and then from the Falklands, we went on to South Georgia, the South Orkney Islands, and all the way down to South Sandwich, and then eventually Antarctica itself. And I don't know, it's hard to really to sum it up. I mean, as you point out, I wrote a whole book about it, didn't I? Empire Antarctica talks a lot about that journey. The narrative itself starts quite a long way into the book of Antarctica, because I wanted to bring that journey to life so much. And approaching the Falkland Islands, it's just, they've got penguin rookeries on the Falklands, that the layers of guano under those rookeries show continuous occupation for the last 2 million years. I mean, the scale of the idea of the world without humans is really evident there. It's everywhere just under the surface. And you can see that human intervention has been scratched so lightly onto those islands, whether I'm talking about the Falklands or South Georgia or the South Orkneys. The South Orkney Islands are wonderful to visit. I mean, they're so beautiful. They're kind of like, it's kind of like imagining the most dramatic Alaskan glaciers you can picture, but then imagine the whole thing sunk into a kind of iron sea, and there's almost no plant life there at all. There's some mosses, but yet they are heaving with life. The beaches are just heaving with seals, elephants, seals, fur seals, all kinds of different birds, and whales are spouting all around the island, because it's part of the South Atlantic, that where the warm water of the Atlantic meets the polar sea, and that brings a kind of churning of life to the surface. So although some people might think of those places as kind of dead or remote, they were thrumming with life, and they offered this really kind of vital glimpse of what the planet is like without human beings. I really, really valued my my time getting to see those places.
Just one more question then from me, and then I'd like you to read a bit of Island Dreams for us, if you would. So, I mean, I would normally expect to get to the end of this interview and ask you, you know, whether or not throughout the journeys in this book you ever did come to some sort of resolution about about that paradox that you mentioned at the beginning. But of course, life for everybody has been sort of overwhelmed this past year by a global pandemic, and I know that you have another book coming out in the new year about working through the pandemic, which we will obviously talk about in the new year when it comes out.
Yeah, I'd love to.
But just give us a brief idea of what it's been like to work as a GP through this pandemic.
Oh, well, it's just been, I think it's quite good to regularly acknowledge just how bloody awful this whole year has been. I think everybody should regularly remind themselves that it's all right to acknowledge this has just been a terrible year. My work, my GP work, which I love, has been made so difficult. It's been kind of transformed out of all recognition from what it used to be because of the necessity of diminishing the footfall through the practice, because of the importance of protecting my most vulnerable patients, because of the difficulty, especially in the early months, of getting adequate access to testing and diagnosis for COVID. It's really pushed us all into a set of extreme circumstances with regard to how we can actually practice medicine safely and look after, keep the rest of the NHS show on the road. But at the same time, I've just been astonished how brilliantly red tape has been slashed. Huge faith has been put in people's professionalism. The kind of barriers between different silos of the professions that I deal with have just all come tumbling down. And so that's something we've got to take from this that's been really, really positive. The facility now with which I communicate with all the other different professionals that I have to in order to ensure the good care of my patients has just improved immeasurably this year, as well as all the kinds of things that we can now do IT-wise in terms of, this time last year, I couldn't sit in my GP surgery and patch myself through to a patient's smartphone and have a video consultation. But now it's something I do every day in order to avoid the possibility of them having to come to the surgery. So we're now in this kind of strange state where we've been through it all before. You know, we went through the dreadful early months of the lockdown and we managed to get the numbers down of all the COVID cases. And now they're climbing again. They're not climbing as fast because we've got all these measures in place, but they're definitely climbing. It's almost like we're listening to a bit of a reprise at the moment. You know, we know the tune and it's been fleshed out in some different harmonies at the moment, but we know the tune and we're much, much better prepared for it this time around. So although I'm quite pessimistic for this winter, I think it's going to be very, very hard, certainly the hardest winter I've ever worked in my medical career. But on the other hand, I'm optimistic about all the things that we've learned and how much better we're getting at managing this disease and how much better we're getting at knowing how to ensure good lockdowns and keep people safe. So you asked me if I would just read a little bit from the beginning of the book that just sets the scene. I should say that this book is chock-a-block full of old maps, and the maps are a way for me not only of giving the text a bit of breathing space, but of allowing like a conversation almost between the text that you read that comes from me as the writer and also the reader's own imagination, when they can look at the map and imagine the place for themselves. So when I read this, I want you all to imagine an 18th century map of Shetland with the islands coloured in pink, crisscrossed with old navigational marks, obsolete navigational marks, and edged with blue. And that's the map that accompanies this kind of opening reading. Hitchhiking north through the islands of Shetland, a Land Rover stopped for me. The driver was a man of about 40. He wore a gas blue boiler suit and his beard was flecked with white. "Where are you bound?" he asked, with a voice like rust and sea spray, an accent more Norse than Scots. "Unst," I said. He told me that off the island of Unst, the northernmost of the Shetland Islands, a black-browed albatross had been seen, a species accustomed to the skerries of the subantarctic. "It must have crossed the equator in a storm," he said, "and got disorientated. Took one look at Unst and thought, that looks like home." I was in search of distant islands, in love with the idea that on a patch of land protected by a circumference of sea, the obligations and irritations of life would dissolve and a singular clarity of mind would descend. It proved more complicated than that. Thinking of islands often returns me in memory to the municipal library I visited as a child. The library was one of the grandest buildings in town, entered directly from the street through heavy brass doors, each one tessellated in panes of glass thick as lenses. By age 8 or 9, I'd exhausted the children's library and been given an adult borrower's ticket. But as my mother browsed the shelves, often as not, I'd sit down on the scratchy carpet tiles and open an immense atlas, running my fingers over distant and unreachable archipelagos as if reading Braille. I hardly dared hope I'd reach any of them, and that I've reached a few is something of a relief. And so the love of islands has always, for me, been inextricable from the love of maps. Cartographers know that to isolate and distill the features of a portion of the Earth's surface in all its inexpressible complexity is to exert power over it. To transfer that distillation onto paper is in some way to encompass it. But it could be said that maps offer only the illusion of understanding a landscape. Encompass, from Latin en, meaning to make or to put in, and compass, to surround, contain, envelop, enclose with steps. Perhaps island maps, reined in by their coasts, offer a special case. They invite the viewer to indulge the imagination, pace a dreamed perimeter. I've always found old maps intoxicating, and their wavering outlines, archaic scripts, obsolete navigational marks, they're palimpsests of the way islands have been imagined over the centuries. In the famous world map in his Atlas of 1570, Ortelius injected vast tracts of pure imagination, including a river of islands draining a mysterious southern continent. By their omissions, all maps leave room for the imagination and for dreams.
So I've been talking to Gavin Francis. We've been talking about his latest book, Island Dreams, Mapping and Obsession, which is out now from Canongate. Gavin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about it.
Thank you, Neil. Always a pleasure.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.